want that more than anything in the world.
Anna Stevenson bent across the desk and kissed Rosie softly on the cheek. At the same time, she squeezed Rosie's hands. Then you've come to the right place. Welcome home, dear.
It was early May, real spring, the time when a young man's fancy is supposed to lightly turn to thoughts of love. A wonderful season and undoubtedly a great emotion, but Norman Daniels had other things on his mind. He had wanted a break, one little break, and now it had come. It had taken too long, almost 3 goddamn weeks, but it had finally come. He sat on a park bench 800 miles from the place where his wife was currently changing hotel sheets, a big man in a red polo shirt and gray gabardine slacks. In one hand, he held a fluorescent green tennis ball. The muscles of his forearm flexed rhythmically as he squeezed it. A second man came across the street, stood at the edge of the sidewalk, looking into the park, then spotted the man on the bench and began walking toward him. He ducked as a frisbee sailed close by, then stopped short as a large German shepherd charged past him, chasing it. This second man was both younger and slighter than the man on the bench. He had a handsome, unreliable face and a tiny Errol Flynn mustache. He stopped in front of the man with a tennis ball in his right hand and looked at him uncertainly. "Help you, bro?" the man with the tennis ball asked. "Is your name Daniels?" The man with the tennis ball nodded that it was. The man with the Errol Flynn mustache pointed across the street at a new high-rise loaded with glass and angles. "Guy in there told me to come over here and see you. He said maybe you could help me with my problem." "Was it Lieutenant Morelli?" the man with the tennis ball asked. "Yeah, that was his name." "And what problem do you have?" "You know," the man with the Errol Flynn mustache said. "Tell you what, bro. Maybe I do, and maybe I don't. Either way, I'm the man, and you're just a greasy little half-breed cock gobbler with a very troubled life. I think you better tell me what I want to hear, don't you? And what I want to hear right now is what kind of problem you got. Say it right out loud." "I'm up on a dope charge," the man with the Errol Flynn mustache said. He looked sullenly at Daniels. "Sold an 8-ball to a narc." "Oops," the man with the tennis ball said. "That's a felony. It can be a felony anyway, but it gets worse, doesn't it? They found something of mine in your wallet, didn't they?" "Yeah, your fucking bank card, just my luck. Find an ATM card in the trash, it belongs to a fucking cop." "Sit down," Daniel said genially. But when the man with the Errol Flynn mustache started to move to the right side of the bench, the cop shook his head impatiently. "Other side, dickweed, other side." The man with the mustache backtracked, then sat gingerly down on Daniels's left side. He watched as the right hand squeezed the tennis ball in a steady, quick rhythm. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. Thick blue veins wriggled up the white underside of the cop's arm like water snakes. The frisbee floated by. The two men watched the German shepherd chase after, its long legs galloping like the legs of a horse. "Beautiful dog," Daniel said. "Shepherds are beautiful dogs. I always like a shepherd, don't you?" "Sure, great," the man with the mustache said, although he actually thought the dog was butt ugly and looked like it would happily chew you a new asshole if you gave it half a chance. "We've got a lot to talk about," the cop with the tennis ball said. In fact, I think this is going to be one of the most important conversations of your young life, my friend. Are you ready for that? The man with the mustache swallowed past some sort of blockage in his throat and wished, for about the 800th time that day, that he had gotten rid of the goddamn bank card. Why hadn't he? Why had he been such a total goddamned idiot? Except he knew why he had been such a total goddamned idiot. Because he'd kept thinking that eventually he might figure out a way to use it. Because he was an optimist. This was America, after all, the land of opportunity. Also because, and this was a lot closer to the nub of the truth, he had sort of forgotten that it was there in his wallet, tucked in behind a bunch of business cards he was always picking up. Coke had that effect on you. It kept you running, but you couldn't fucking remember why you were running. The cop was looking at him, and he was smiling, but there was no smile in his eyes. The eyes looked famished. All at once, the man with the mustache felt like one of the three little pigs sitting on a park bench next to the big bad wolf. Listen, man, I never use your bank card. Let's just get that up front. They told you that, didn't they? I never fucking used it once. Of course you didn't, the cop said, half laughing. You couldn't get the PIN number. It's based on my home phone number and my number's unlisted, like most cops. But I bet you already know that, right? I bet you checked. No, the man with the mustache said. No, I didn't. He had, of course. He had checked the phone book after trying several different combinations of the street address on the card and the zip code with no luck. He had punched ATM buttons all over the city at first. He had punched buttons until his fingers were sore and he felt like an asshole playing the world's most miserly slot machine. So, what's gonna happen when we check the computer runs on Merchants Bank ATM machines? The cop asked. We're not gonna find my card in the cancel retry column about a billion times? Hey, if we don't, I'll buy you a steak dinner. What do you think about that, bro? The man with the mustache didn't know what to think about it or anything else. He was getting a very bad feeling, a bitch of a bad feeling. Meanwhile, the cop's fingers went on working the tennis ball, in and out, in and out, in and out. It was creepy how he never stopped doing that. Your name's Ramon Sanders, the cop named Daniel said. You got a rap sheet long as my arm. Theft, con, dope, vice, everything but assault, battery, crimes of that nature. No mixing it up for you, right? You fags don't like getting hit, do you? Even the ones that look like Schwarzenegger. Oh, they don't mind wearing a security t-shirt and flexing their pecs for the limousines in front of some homo club, but if anyone actually starts hitting, you guys go flat in a hurry, don't you? Ramon Sanders said nothing. It seemed by far the wisest course. I don't mind hitting, the cop named Daniel said. Kicking either. Even biting. He spoke almost reflectively. He seemed to be looking both at and beyond the German Shepherd, which was now trotting back in their direction with the frisbee in its mouth. What do you think of that, Angel Eyes? Ramon went on saying nothing, and he tried to keep a poker face, but a lot of little lights inside his head were turning red, and a dismaying tingle had begun to shake its way through his nerve tree. His heart was picking up speed, like a train leaving the station and heading into open country. He kept snatching little glances of the big man in the red polo shirt and liking less and less what he saw. The guy's right forearm was totally flexed now, veins fat with blood, muscles popped like freshly risen bread rolls. Daniels didn't seem to mind Ramon's failure to answer. The face he turned toward the smaller man was smiling, or appeared to be smiling, if you ignored the eyes. The eyes were as blank and shiny as two new quarters. I got good news for you, little hero. You can do the stroll on the dope charge. Give me a little help and you're as free as a bird. Now, what do you think about that? What he thought was that he wanted to go right on keeping his mouth shut, but that no longer seemed like an option. This time the cop wasn't just rolling on. This time he was waiting for an answer. That's great, Ramon said, hoping he was giving the right one. That's great, really excellent. Thanks for giving me a break. Well, maybe I like you, Ramon, the cop said, And then he did an astounding thing, something Ramon never would have expected from a screwhead ex-gyrene like this guy. He plopped his left hand into Ramon's crotch and began giving him a rubdown right out in front of God, the kids on the playground, and anybody who cared to take a look. He slid his hand in a gentle clockwise motion, his palm moving back and forth and up and down over the little patch of flesh, which had more or less run Ramon's life ever since two of his father's buddies, men Ramon was supposed to call Uncle Bill and Uncle Carlo, had taken turns blowing him when he was 9 years old. And what happened next was probably not very extraordinary, although it seemed very fucking bizarre right then. He began to get hard. "Yeah, maybe I like you. Maybe I like you a lot, greasy little cocksucker in shiny black pants and pointy shoes. What's not to like?" The cop kept on giving his cock a shoeshine while he talked. He varied his stroke every now and then, applying a little squeeze that caused Ramon to gasp. "And it's a good thing I like you, Ramon. You better believe it, because they really nailed you this time. Felony bust. But you know what bothers me? Leffingwell and Brewster, the cops who busted you, were laughing in the squad room this morning. They were laughing about you, and that was okay, but I also have this feeling that they were laughing about me, and that's not okay. I don't like for people to laugh about me, and I generally don't put up with it. But this morning I had to, and this afternoon I'm going to be your best friend. I'm going to lose some pretty serious drug charges, even though you had my fucking bank card. Can you guess why?" The Frisbee floated by again with the German Shepherd in close pursuit, but this time Ramon Sanders barely saw it. He was stiff as a rail spike under the cop's hand and as scared as a mouse under the claws of a cat. The hand squeezed harder this time, and Ramon uttered a hoarse little howl. His café au lait skin was running with sweat. His mustache looked like a dead earthworm after a hard rain. "Can you guess, Ramon?" "No," Ramon said. "Because the woman who ditched the card was my wife," Daniel said. "That's mostly why Leffingwell and Brewster were laughing. That's my deduction. She takes my bank card, she uses it to draw a few $100 out of the bank, money I earned, and when the card turns up again, it's in the possession of a greasy little spick cocksucker named Ramon. No wonder they're laughing." "Please," Ramon wanted to say, "please don't hurt me. I'll tell you anything, but please don't hurt me." He wanted to say those things, but he couldn't say a word, not one. His asshole had contracted until it felt roughly the size of an inner tube valve. The big cop leaned closer to him, close enough so that Ramon could smell cigarettes and scotch on his breath. "Now that I've shared with you, I want you to share with me." The rubbing stopped, and strong fingers curled around Ramon's testes through the thin fabric of his slacks. The shape of his erect penis was clear above the cop's hand. It looked like one of those toy bats you could buy at a baseball park souvenir stand. Ramon could feel the strength in that hand. "And you better share the right thing, Ramon. Do you know why?" Ramon shook his head numbly. He felt as if someone had turned on a warm water tap somewhere in his body and his entire skin was leaking. Daniels extended his right hand, the one with the tennis ball, until it was under Ramon's nose. Then he closed his hand with a sudden vicious snap. There was a pop and a brief, harsh whisper, as his fingers punched through the ball's furry, fluorescent skin. The ball collapsed inward, then turned halfway inside out. "I can do that with my left hand, too," Daniel said. "Do you believe that?" Ramon tried to say he did, and found he still couldn't talk. He nodded instead. "Will you keep it in mind?" Ramon nodded again. "Okie doke. So, now, here's what I want you to tell me, Ramon. I know you're just a stinking little spick rump wrangler who doesn't know much about women, except maybe for fucking your mother up the ass in your younger years. You just got that motherfucker look about you somehow, but you go on and use your imagination. How do you think it feels to come home and find out that your wife, the woman who promised to love, honor, and fucking obey you, has run off with your bank card? How do you think it feels to find out she used it to pay for her fucking vacation, and then she stuffed it in a bus terminal garbage can for a greasy little penis vacuum like you to find?
Not too good, Ramon whispered. I bet it don't feel too good. Please don't hurt me, officer. Please don't.
Daniels slowly tightened his hand, tightened it until the tendons in his wrist stood out like the strings on a guitar. A wave of pain, heavy as liquid lead, rolled into Ramon's belly, and he tried to scream. Nothing came out but a hoarse exhalation.
Not too good?
Daniels whispered in his face. His breath was warm and steamy and boozy and cigarette-y. Is that the best you can do? What a fucking numbnuts you are.
Still, I guess it's not an entirely wrong answer either.
The hand loosened, but only a little. Ramon's lower belly was a lake of agony, but his penis was as hard as ever. He had never been into pain. Whatever drove the bondage freaks was totally beyond him. And he could only suppose he still had a hard-on because the blood in his cock was trapped there by the heel of the cop's hand. He swore to himself that if he got out of this alive, he would go directly to St. Patrick's and say 50 Hail Marys. 50. 150. They're laughing at me in there, the cop said, lifting his chin in the direction of the brand new cop shop across the street. They're laughing all right. Oh, yeah. Big, tough Norman Daniels. And guess what? His wife ran out on him, but she took the time to clean out most of the ready before she went. Daniels made an inarticulate growling sound, the sort of sound that a person should only have to hear while visiting the zoo, and gave Ramon's balls another squeeze. The pain was unbearable. He leaned forward and vomited between his knees, white chunks of curd laced with brown streaks that was probably the remains of the quesadilla he had eaten for lunch. Daniels did not seem to notice. He was gazing into the sky above the jungle gym, lost in his own world. I should let them dance you around so even more people can laugh, he asked, so that they can yuck it up at the courthouse as well as at the police station? I don't think so. He turned and looked into Ramon's eyes. He smiled. The smile made Ramon want to scream.
Here comes the big question, the cop said. And if you lie, little hero, I'm going to rip your scrot off and feed it to you.
Daniel squeezed Ramon's crotch again, and now folds of darkness began to fall across Ramon's vision. He fought them desperately. If he passed out, the cop was apt to kill him just for spite.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, Ramon wept. I understand. I understand.
You were at the bus station, and you saw her stick the card in the trash. That much I know. What I need to know is where she went next.
Ramon could have wept with relief because, although there was no reason why he should be able to answer this question, it just so happened he could. He had looked after the woman once to make sure she wasn't looking back at him, and then, 5 minutes later, long after he had slid the green plastic card into his wallet, he had spotted her again. She had been hard to miss with that red thing over her hair. It was as bright as the side of a freshly painted barn.
She was at the ticket windows, Ramon cried out of the darkness that was relentlessly enveloping him. At the windows!
This effort was rewarded by another ruthless squeeze. Ramon began to feel as if his balls had been torn open, doused with lighter fluid, and then set on fire.
I know she was at the windows! Daniels half laughed, half screamed at him. What else would she be doing at Portside if she wasn't going someplace on a bus, doing a sociological study on scumbuckets like you? Which ticket window? That's what I want to know. Which fucking window and what fucking time?
And oh, thank God, thank Jesus and Mother Mary, he knew the answers to both of those questions, too.
Continental Express, he cried, now separated from his own voice by what felt like miles. I seen her at the Continental Express window, 10:30, 10:45.
Continental? You're sure? Ramon Sanders didn't answer. He collapsed sideways on the bench, one hand dangling, slim fingers outstretched. His face was dead white except for two small purplish patches high on his cheeks. A young man and a young woman walked by, looked at the man lying on the bench, then looked at Daniels, who had by now removed his hand from Ramon's crotch.
Don't worry, Daniel said, giving the couple a large smile. He's epileptic. He paused and let his smile widen. I'll take care of him. I'm a cop. They walked on a little faster and didn't look back. Daniel's got an arm around Ramon's shoulders. The bones in there felt as fragile as birds' wings. Upsy-daisy, big boy, he said, and hauled Ramon up to a sitting position. Ramon's head lolled like the head of a flower on a broken stalk. He started to slide back down immediately, making little thick grunts in his throat. Daniels hauled him up again, and this time Ramon balanced. Daniel sat there beside him, watching the German Shepherd race joyfully after the Frisbee. He envied dogs. He really did. They had no responsibilities, no need to work. Not in this country, anyhow. All food was provided for them, plus a place to sleep, and they didn't even have to worry about heaven or hell when the ride was over. He had once asked Father O'Brien back in Aubreyville about that, and Father had told him that pets had no souls. When they died, they just winked out like 4th of July sparklers. It was true that the Shep had probably lost his balls not even 6 months after he was born, but in a way, that's a blessing, too, Daniels murmured. He patted Ramon's crotch, where the penis was now deflating, even as the testicles began to swell. Right, big boy? Ramon muttered deep in his throat. It was the sound of a man having a terrible dream. Still, Daniels thought, what you got was what you got, and so you might as well be content with it. He might be lucky enough to be a German Shepherd in his next life, with nothing to do but chase Frisbees in the park and stick his head out of the back window of the car on his way home to a nice big supper of Purina dog chow. But in this one, he was a man with a man's problems. At least he was a man, unlike his little buddy. Continental Express. Ramon had seen her at the Continental Express ticket window at 10:30 or 10:45. And she wouldn't have waited long. She was too scared of him to wait for long. He'd bet his life on that. So he was looking for a bus that had left Portside between, say, 11 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon, probably headed for a large city where she felt she could lose herself. But you can't do that, Daniel said. He watched the Shep jump and snatch the Frisbee out of the air with its long white teeth. No, she couldn't do that. She might think she could, but she was wrong. He would work on it weekends to start with, mostly using the phone. He would have to do it that way. There was a lot going on at the company store, a big bust coming down, his bust if he was lucky. But that was all right. He'd be ready to turn his full attention to Rose soon enough, and before long she was going to regret what she had done. Yes, she was going to regret it for the rest of her life, a period of time which might be short, but which would be extremely, well, extremely intense, he said out loud, and yes, that was the right word, exactly the right word. He got up and walked briskly back toward the street and the police station on the other side, not wasting a second glance on the semi-conscious young man sitting on the bench with his head down and his hands laced limply together in his crotch. In Detective Inspector Second Grade Norman Daniels's mind, Ramon had ceased to exist. Daniels was thinking about his wife and all the things she had to learn, about all the things they had to talk about, and they would talk about them, just as soon as he tracked her down. All sorts of things, ships and sails and sealing wax, not to mention what should happen to wives who promised to love, honor, and obey, and then took a powder with their husbands' bank cards in their purses. All those things. They would talk about them up close.
She was making another bed, but this time it was all right. It was a different bed, in a different room, in a different city. Best of all, this was a bed she had never slept in and never would. A month had passed since she had left the house 800 miles east of here, and things were a lot better. Currently, her worst problem was her back, and even that was getting better, she was sure of it. Right now, the ache around her kidneys was strong and unpleasant, true enough, but this was her 18th room of the day, and when she'd begun at the White Stone, she'd been close to fainting after a dozen rooms and unable to go on after 14. She'd had to ask Pam for help. 4 weeks could make a hell of a difference in a person's outlook, Rosie was discovering, especially if it was 4 weeks without any hard shots to the kidneys or the pit of the stomach. Still, for now it was enough. She went to the hall door, poked her head out, and looked in both directions. She saw nothing but a few room service trays left over from breakfast, Pam's trolley down by the Lake Michigan suite at the end of the hall, and her own trolley out here in front of 624. Rosie lifted a pile of fresh washcloths stacked on the end of the trolley, exposing a banana. She took it, walked back across the room to the overstuffed chair by 624's window, and sat down. She peeled a piece of fruit and began to eat it slowly, looking out at the lake, which glimmered like a mirror on this still, rainy afternoon in May. Her heart and mind were filled with a huge, simple emotion. Gratitude. Her life wasn't perfect, at least not yet, but it was better than she ever would have believed on that day in mid-April when she had stood on the porch of Daughters and Sisters, looking at the intercom box and the keyhole that had been filled with metal. At that moment, she had seen nothing in the future but darkness and misery. Now her kidneys hurt and her feet hurt, and she was very aware that she did not want to spend the rest of her life as an off-the-books chambermaid in the Whitestone Hotel. But the banana tasted good, and the chair felt wonderful beneath her. At that moment, she would not have traded her place in the scheme of things for anyone's. In the weeks since she had left Norman, Rosie had become exquisitely aware of small pleasures. Reading for half an hour before bed, talking with some of the other women about movies or TV shows as they did the supper dishes together, or taking 5 minutes off to sit down and eat a banana. It was also wonderful to know what was coming next, and to feel sure it wasn't going to include something sudden and painful. To know, for instance, that there were only 2 more rooms to go, and then she and Pam could go down in the service elevator and out the back door. On the way to the bus stop, she was now able to differentiate easily between orange, red, and blue line buses, they would probably pop into the hot pot for coffee. Simple things, simple pleasures. The world could be good. She supposed she had known that as a child, but she had forgotten. Now she was learning it over again, and it was a sweet lesson. She didn't have all she wanted, not by any means, but she had enough for now, especially since she didn't know what the rest might be. That would have to wait until she was out of Daughters and Sisters, but she had a feeling she would be moving soon, probably the next time a room turned up vacant on what the residents at DNS called Anna's List. A shadow fell across the open hotel doorway, and before she could even think where she might hide her half-eaten banana, let alone get to her feet, Pam poked her head in. "Peek, baby," she said and giggled when Rosie jumped. "Don't ever do that, Pam. You almost gave me a heart attack." "Ah, they'd never fire you for sitting down and eating a banana," Pam said. "You should see some of the stuff that goes on in this place." "What have you got left? 22 and 20? "Yes." "Want some help?" "Oh, you don't have to. I don't mind," Pam said. "Really, with 2 of us on the case, we can turn those 2 rooms in 15 minutes. What do you say?" "I say yes," Rosie told her gratefully. "And I'm buying at the hot pot after work. Pie as well as coffee, if you want." Pam grinned. "If they've got any of that chocolate cream, I want, believe me." Good days. 4 weeks of good days, give or take. That night, as she lay on her cot with her hands laced behind her head, looking into the darkness and listening to the woman who had come in the previous evening, sobbing quietly 2 or 3 cots down on her left, Rosie thought that the days were mostly good for a negative reason. There was no Norman in them. She sensed, however, that it would soon take more than his absence to satisfy and fulfill her. "Not quite yet, though," she thought, and closed her eyes. "For now, what I've got is still plenty. These simple days of work, food, sleep, and no Norman Daniels." Then there was darkness, and a night they were becoming more frequent, when there were no bad dreams. Providence. When Rosie and Pam Haverford came down in the service elevator after work on the following Wednesday, Pam looked pale and unwell. "Oh, it's my period," she said when Rosie expressed concern. "I'm having cramps like a bastard. Do you want to stop for a coffee?" Pam thought about it, then shook her head. "You go on without me. All I want to do right now is go back to DNS and find an empty bedroom before everyone shows up from work and starts yakking. Gobble some My Doll and sleep for a couple of hours. If I do that, maybe I'll feel like a human being again." "I'll come with you," Rosie said as the elevator doors opened and they stepped out. Pam shook her head. "No, you don't," she said, and her face lit in a brief smile. "I can make it on my own. I'm just fine. And you're old enough to have a cup of coffee without a chaperone. Who knows? You might even meet someone interesting." Rosie sighed. To Pam, someone interesting always meant a man, usually the kind with muscles that stood out under their form-fitting T-shirts like geological landmarks. And as far as Rosie was concerned, she could do without that kind of man for the rest of her life. Besides, she was married. She glanced down at her wedding band and diamond engagement ring inside it as they stepped out onto the street. How much that glance had to do with what happened a short time later was something of which she was never sure. But it did place the engagement ring, which in the ordinary course of things she hardly ever thought of at all, somewhere toward the front of her mind. It was a little over a carat, by far the most expensive thing her husband had ever given her, and until that day the idea that it belonged to her, and she could dispose of it if she wanted to, and in any way she wanted to, had never crossed her mind. Rosie waited at the bus stop around the corner from the hotel with Pam, in spite of Pam's protestations that it was totally unnecessary. She really didn't like the way Pam looked, with all the color gone from her cheeks and dark smudges under her eyes and little pain lines running down from the corners of her mouth. Besides, it felt good to be looking out for someone else, instead of the other way around. She actually came quite close to getting on the bus with Pam just to make sure she got back all right. But in the end, the call of fresh, hot coffee and maybe a piece of pie was just too strong. She stood on the curb and waved at Pam when Pam sat down beside one of the bus windows. Pam waved back as the bus pulled away. Rosie stood where she was for a moment, then turned and started walking down Hitchens Boulevard toward the hot pot. Her mind turned, naturally enough, back to her first walk in this city. She couldn't recall very much of those hours. What she remembered most was being afraid and disoriented. But at least two figures stood out like rocks in a billowing mist. The pregnant woman and the man with the David Crosby mustache, him particularly, leaning in the tavern doorway with a beer stein in his hand and looking at her, talking, hey baby, to her, or at her. These recollections possessed her mind wholly for a little while, as only our worst recollections can, memories of times when we have felt lost and helpless, utterly unable to exert any control over our own lives. And she walked past the hot pot without even seeing it, her heedless eyes blank and full of dismay. She was still thinking about the man in the tavern doorway, thinking about how much he had frightened her and how much he had reminded her of Norman. It wasn't anything in his face. Mostly it had been a matter of posture. The way he'd stood there, as if every muscle was ready to flex and leap, and it would only take a single glance of acknowledgement from her to set him off. A hand seized her upper arm, and Rosie nearly shrieked. She looked around, expecting either Norman or the man with the dark red mustache. Instead, she saw a young fellow in a conservative summer weight suit. "Sorry if I startled you," he said, "but for a second there I was sure you were going to step right out into the traffic." She looked around and saw that she was standing on the corner of Hitchens and Water Tower Drive, one of the busiest intersections in the city, and at least three full blocks past the hot pot, maybe four. Traffic raced by like a metal river. It suddenly occurred to her that the young man beside her might have saved her life. Thank you. A lot. "Not a problem," he said, and on the far side of Water Tower, "Walk" flashed out in white letters. The young man gave Rosie a final, curious glance, and then stepped off the curb and into the crosswalk with the rest of the pedestrians and was borne away. Rosie stayed where she was, feeling the momentary dislocation and deep relief of someone who wakes from a really bad dream. And that's exactly what I was having, she thought. I was awake and walking down the street, but I was still having a bad dream, or a flashback. She looked down and saw she was holding her purse clamped tightly against her midsection in both hands, as she had held it during that long, bewildering tramp in search of Durham Avenue 5 weeks ago. She slipped the strap over her shoulder, turned around, and began retracing her steps. The city's fashionable shopping section started beyond Water Tower Drive. The area she was now passing through as she left Water Tower behind consisted of much smaller shops. Many of them looked a little seedy, a trifle desperate around the edges. Rosie walked slowly, looking in the windows of second-hand clothing stores, trying to pass themselves off as grunge boutiques. Shoe stores with signs reading "Buy American" and "Clearance Sale" in the windows. A discount place called No More Than Five, its window heaped with doll babies made in Mexico or Manila, a leather goods place called Motorcycle Mama, and a store called Avec Plaisir with a startling array of goods, dildos, handcuffs, and crotchless underwear displayed on black velvet. She looked in here for quite a while, marveling at this stuff which had been put out for anyone passing to see, and at last crossed the street. Half a block farther up, she could see the hot pot, but she had decided to forego the coffee and pie after all. She would simply catch the bus and go on back to D&S. Enough adventures for one day. Except that wasn't what happened. On the far corner of the intersection she had just crossed was a nondescript storefront with a neon sign in the window reading, "Pawns, Loans, Fine Jewelry Bought and Sold." It was the last service which caught Rosie's attention. She looked down at her engagement ring again and remembered something Norman had told her not long before they were married. "If you wear that on the street, wear it with the stone turned in and toward your palm, Rose. That's a hell of a big rock, and you're just a little girl." She had asked him once, this was before he had begun teaching her that it was safer not to ask questions, how much it had cost. He had answered with a headshake and a small, indulgent smile, the smile of a parent whose child wants to know why the sky is blue or how much snow there is at the North Pole. "Never mind," he said. "Content yourself with knowing it was either the rock or a new Buick. I decided on the rock because I love you, Rose." Now, standing here on this street corner, she could still remember how that made her feel. Afraid. Because you had to be afraid of a man capable of such extravagance, a man who could choose a ring over a new car, but a little breathless and sexy, too, because it was romantic. He had bought her a diamond so big that it wasn't safe to flash it on the street, a diamond as big as the Ritz. "Because I love you, Rose." And perhaps he had. But that had been 14 years ago. And the girl he'd loved had possessed clear eyes and high breasts and a flat stomach and long, strong thighs. There had been no blood in that girl's urine when she went to the bathroom. Rosie stood on the corner near the storefront with the neon in the window and looked down at her diamond engagement ring. She waited to see what she would feel, an echo of fear or perhaps even romance. And when she felt nothing at all, she turned toward the pawn shop's door. She would be leaving daughters and sisters soon, and if there was someone inside this place who would give her a reasonable sum of money for her ring, she could leave clean, owing nothing for her room and board, and maybe even with a few $100 left over. "Or maybe I just want to be rid of it," she thought. "Maybe I don't want to spend even another day carting around the Buick he never bought." The sign on the door read, "Liberty City, Loan and Pawn." That struck her as momentarily strange. She had heard several nicknames for this city, but all of them had to do either with the lake or the weather. Then she dismissed the thought opened the door, and went inside. She had expected it to be dark, and it was dark, but it was also unexpectedly golden inside the Liberty City Loan and Pawn. The sun was low in the sky now, shining straight down Hitchens, and it fell through the pawn shop's west-facing windows in long, warm beams. One of them turned a hanging saxophone into an instrument which looked as if it were made of fire. That's not accidental either, Rosie thought. Someone hung that sax there on purpose. Someone smart. Probably true, but she still felt a little enchanted. Even the smell of the place added to that sense of enchantment, a smell of dust and age and secrets. Very faintly off to her left, she could hear many clocks ticking softly. She walked slowly up the center aisle, past ranks of acoustic guitars strung up by their necks on one side, and glass cases filled with appliances and stereo equipment on the other. There seemed to be a great many of those oversized, multifunction sound systems that were called boom boxes on the TV shows. At the far end of this aisle was a long counter with another neon sign bent in an arc overhead. Gold, silver, fine jewelry, it said in blue, then below it in red. We buy, we sell, we trade. Yes, but do you crawl on your belly like a reptile? Rosie thought with a small ghost of a smile, and approached the counter. A man was sitting on a stool behind it. There was a jeweler's loop in his eye. He was using it to look at something which lay on a pad in front of him. When she got a little closer, Rosie saw that the item under examination was a pocket watch with its back off. The man behind the counter was poking into it with a steel probe so thin she could barely see it. He was young, she thought, maybe not even 30 yet. His hair was long, almost to his shoulders, and he was wearing a blue silk vest over a plain white undershirt. She thought the combination unconventional, but rather dashing. There was movement off to her left. She turned in that direction and saw an older gentleman squatting on the floor and going through piles of paperbacks stacked under a sign reading, "The Good Old Stuff." His topcoat was spread out around him in a fan, and his briefcase, black, old-fashioned, and starting to come unsprung at the seams, stood patiently beside him like a faithful dog. "Help you, ma'am?" She returned her attention to the man behind the counter, who had removed the loop and was now looking at her with a friendly grin. His eyes were hazel with a greenish undertint, very pretty, and she wondered briefly if Pam might classify him as someone interesting. She guessed not. Not enough tectonic plates sliding around under the shirt. "Maybe you can," she said. She slipped off her wedding ring and her engagement ring, then put the plain gold band into her pocket. It felt strange not to be wearing it, but she supposed she could get used to that. A woman capable of walking out of her own house for good without even a change of underwear could probably get used to quite a lot. She laid the diamond down on the velvet pad beside the old watch the jeweler had been working on. "How much would you say that's worth?" she asked him. Then, as an afterthought, she added, "And how much could you give me for it?" He slipped the ring over the end of his thumb, then held it up into the dusty sunbeam slanting in over his shoulder through the third of the west-facing windows. The stone sent back sparks of multicolored fire into her eyes, and for just a moment she felt a pang of regret. Then the jeweler gave her a quick look, just a glance, really, but it was long enough for her to see something in his hazel eyes she didn't immediately understand, a look that seemed to say, "Are you joking?" "What?" she asked. "What is it?" "Nothing," he said. "Just a mo." He screwed the loop back into his eye and took a good long look at the stone in her engagement ring. When he looked up the second time, his eyes were surer and easier to read. Impossible not to read, really. Suddenly Rosie knew everything, but she felt no surprise, no anger, and no real regret. The best she could do was a weary sort of embarrassment. Why had she never realized before? How could she have been such a chump? "You weren't," that deep voice answered her. "You really weren't, Rosie. If you hadn't known on some level that the ring was a fake, known it almost from the start, you would have come into a place like this a lot sooner. Did you ever really believe, once you got past your 22nd birthday, that is, that Norman Daniels would have given you a ring worth not just hundreds, but thousands of dollars? Did you really? No, she supposed not. She'd never been worth it to him, for one thing. For another, a man who had three locks on the front door, three on the back, motion sensor lights in the yard, and a touch alarm on his new central automobile, would never have let his wife do the marketing with a diamond as big as the Ritz on her finger. "It's a fake, isn't it?" she asked the jeweler. "Well," he said, "it's a perfectly real zirconia, but it's certainly not a diamond, if that's what you mean." "Of course it's what I mean," she said. "What else would I mean?" "Are you okay?" the jeweler asked. He looked genuinely concerned, and she had an idea, now that she was seeing him close up, that he was closer to 25 than 30. "Hell," she said, "I don't know. Probably." She took a Kleenex out of her purse, though, just in case of a tearful outburst. These days she never knew when one was coming. Or maybe a good laughing jag. She'd had several of those as well. It would be nice if she could avoid both extremes, at least for the time being. Nice to leave this place with at least a few shreds of dignity. "I hope so," he said. "Because you're in good company. Believe me, you are. You'd be surprised how many ladies, ladies just like you..." "Oh, stop," she told him. "When I need something uplifting, I'll buy a support bra." She had never in her life said anything remotely like that to a man. It was downright suggestive. But she had never felt like this in her whole life. As if she were spacewalking or running giddily across a tightrope with no net beneath. And wasn't it perfect in a way? Wasn't it the only fitting epilogue to her marriage? "I had decided on the rock," she heard him say in her mind. His voice had been shaking with sentiment, his gray eyes actually a little moist. "Because I love you, Rose." For a moment, the laughing jag was very close. She held it at arm's length by sheer force of will. "Is it worth anything?" she asked. "Anything at all? Or is it just something he got out of a gum machine somewhere?" He didn't bother with the loop this time, just held the ring up into the sunbeam again. "Actually, it is worth a bit," he said, sounding relieved to be able to pass on a little good news. "The stone's a 10-buck item, but the setting, that might have gone as much as 200 bucks retail. Of course, I couldn't give you that," he added hurriedly. "My dad'd read me the riot act, wouldn't he, Robbie?" "Your dad always reads you the riot act," said the old man, squatting by the paperbacks. "That's what kids are for." He didn't look up. The jeweler glanced at him, glanced back at Rosie, and stuck a finger into his half-open mouth, miming a wretch. Rosie hadn't seen that one since high school, and it made her smile. The man in the vest smiled back. "I could give you 50 for it," he said. "Interested?" "No, thanks." She picked up the ring, looked at it thoughtfully, then wrapped it in the unused Kleenex she was holding. "You check any of the other shops along here," he said. "If anyone says they'll give you more, I'll match the best offer. That's Dad's policy, and it's a good one." She dropped the Kleenex into her purse and snapped it shut. "Thanks, but I guess not," she said. "I'll hang on to it." She was aware that the man who'd been checking out the paperbacks, the one the jeweler had called Robbie, was now looking at her, and with an odd expression of concentration on his face. But Rosie decided she didn't care. Let him look. It was a free country. "The man who gave me that ring said it was worth as much as a brand new car," she said. "Do you believe that?" "Yes," he replied with no hesitation, and she remembered his telling her she was in good company, that lots of ladies came in here and learned unpleasant truths about their treasures. She guessed this man, although still young, must already have heard a great many variations on the same basic theme. "I suppose you do," she said. "Well, then, you should understand why I want to keep the ring. If I ever start getting woozy about someone else, or even think I am, I can dig it out and look at it while I wait for the fever to pass." She was thinking of Pam Haverford, who had long, twisting scars on both forearms. In the summer of 92, her husband had thrown her through a storm door while he was drunk. Pam had raised her arms to protect her face as she went through the glass, and the result had been 60 stitches in one arm and 105 in the other. Yet she still almost melted with happiness. If a construction worker or house painter whistled at her legs when she walked by. And what did you call that? Endurance or stupidity? Resilience or amnesia? Rose had come to think of it as Haverford syndrome, and only hoped that she herself could avoid it. "Whatever you say, ma'am," the jeweler replied. "I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, though. Myself, I think it's why pawn shops have such a bad rep. We almost always get the job of telling people that things aren't what they're cracked up to be. Nobody likes that." "No," she agreed. "Nobody likes that, Mr. Steiner," he said. "Bill Steiner. My dad's Abe Steiner. Here's our card." He held one out, but she shook her head, smiling. "I'd have no use for it. Have a nice day, Mr. Steiner." She started back toward the door, this time taking the third aisle because the elderly gentleman had advanced a few steps toward her with his briefcase in one hand and a few of the old paperbacks in the other. She wasn't sure he wanted to talk to her, but she was very sure that she didn't want to talk to him. All she wanted right now was to make a quick exit from Liberty City Loan and Pawn, to climb aboard a bus and get busy forgetting she had ever been here. She was only vaguely aware that she was passing through an area of the pawn shop where clusters of small statuary and pictures, both framed and unframed, had been gathered together on the dusty shelves. Her head was up, but she was looking at nothing. She was not in the mood to appreciate art, fine or otherwise. So her sudden, almost skidding stop was all the more remarkable. It was as if she never saw the picture at all, at least on that first occasion. It was as if the picture saw her. Its powerful attraction was without precedent in her life. But this did not strike Rosie as extraordinary. She had been living an unprecedented life for over a month now. Nor did that attraction strike her, at first anyway, as abnormal. The reason for this was simple. After 14 years of marriage to Norman Daniels, years when she had been all but cut off from the rest of the world, she had no tools for judging the normal from the abnormal. Her yardstick for measuring how the world behaved in given situations mostly consisted of TV dramas and the occasional movie he had taken her to. Norman Daniels would go see anything starring Clint Eastwood. Within the framework provided by those media, her reaction to the picture seemed almost normal. In the movies and on TV, people were always getting swept off their feet. And really, none of that mattered. What did was how the picture called to her, making her forget what she had just found out about her ring, making her forget that she wanted to get away from the pawn shop, making her forget how glad her sore feet were going to be when she saw the blue line bus pulling up in front of the hot pot, making her forget everything. She only thought, "Look at that. Isn't that the most wonderful picture?" It was an oil painting in a wooden frame about 3 feet long and 2 feet high, leaning against a stopped clock on the left end and a small naked cherub on the right end. There were pictures all around it. An old tinted photograph of St. Paul's Cathedral, a watercolor of fruit in a bowl, gondolas at dawn on the Grand Canal, a hunting print which showed a pack of the unspeakable chasing a pair of the uneatable across a misty English moor. But she hardly gave them a glance. It was the picture of the woman on the hill she was interested in, and only that. In both subject and execution, it was not much different from pictures moldering away in pawn shops, curio shops, and roadside bargain barns all over the country, all over the world, for that matter. But it filled her eyes and her mind with a sort of clean, revelatory excitement that belongs only to the works of art that deeply move us. The song that made us cry. The story that made us see the world clearly from another's perspective, at least for a while. The poem that made us glad to be alive. The dance that made us forget for a few minutes that someday we will not be. Her emotional reaction was so sudden, so hot, and so completely without connection to her real practical life, that at first her mind simply floundered, with no idea at all of how to cope with this unexpected burst of fireworks. For that moment or two, she was like a transmission that has suddenly popped out of gear and into neutral. Although the engine was revving like crazy, nothing was happening. Then the clutch engaged, and the transmission slipped smoothly back into place. "It's what I want for my new place. That's why I'm excited," she thought. "It's exactly what I want to make it mine." She seized on this thought eagerly and gratefully. It would only be a single room, true enough, but she had been promised it would be a large room with a little kitchen alcove and an attached bathroom. In any case, it would be the first place in her whole life that was hers and hers alone. That made it important, and that made the thing she chose for it important, too. And the first would be the most important of all, because it would set the tone for everything that followed. Yes, no matter how nice it might be, the room would be a place where dozens of single, low-income people had lived before her, and more dozens would live after her. But it was going to be an important place, all the same. These last 5 weeks had been an interim period, a hiatus between the old life and the new. When she moved into the room she had been promised, her new life, her single life, would really begin. And this picture, one Norman had never seen and passed judgment on, one that was just hers, could be the symbol of that new life. This was how her mind, sane, reasonable, and quite unprepared to admit or even recognize anything which smacked of the supernatural or paranormal, simultaneously explained, rationalized, and justified her sudden spike reaction to the picture of the woman on the hill. It was the only painting in the aisle that was covered with glass. Rosie had an idea that oil paintings usually weren't glassed in, maybe because they had to breathe or something. And there was a small yellow sticker in the lower left-hand corner. $75 or... ? It said. She reached out with hands that trembled slightly and took hold of the frame's sides. She lifted the picture carefully off the shelf and carried it back up the aisle. The old man with the battered briefcase was still there and still watching her, but Rosie hardly saw him. She went directly to the counter and put the picture carefully down in front of Bill Steiner. "Found something you fancy?" he asked her. "Yes." She tapped the price sticker in the corner of the frame. $75 or ? It says. "You told me you could give me 50 for my engagement ring. Would you be willing to trade, even Stephen, my ring for this picture?" Steiner walked down his side of the counter, flipped up the pass-through at the end, and came around to Rosie's side. He looked at the picture as carefully as he had looked at her ring, but this time he looked with a certain amusement. "I don't remember this. I don't think I've ever seen it before. Must be something the old man picked up. He's the art lover of the family. I'm just a glorified Mr. Fix-It." "Does that mean you can't..." "Dicker? Bite your tongue. I'll dicker until the cows come home if you let me. But this time I don't have to. I'm happy to do it your way. Even swapsies. Then I don't have to watch you walk out of here with your face practically dragging on the floor." And here was another first. Before she knew what she was doing, Rosie had wrapped her arms around Bill Steiner's neck and given him a brief, enthusiastic hug. "Thank you," she cried. "Thanks so much." Steiner laughed. "Oh, boy, you're welcome," he said. "I think that's the first time I've ever been hugged by a customer in these hallowed halls. See any other pictures you really want, lady?" The old fellow in the topcoat, the one Steiner had called Robbie, walked over to look at the picture. "Considering what most pawn shop patrons are like, that's probably a blessing," he said. Bill Steiner nodded. "You have a point." She barely heard them. She was rooting through her purse, hunting for the twist of Kleenex with a ring in it. Finding it took her longer than it needed to because her eyes kept wandering back to the picture on the counter. Her picture. For the first time, she thought of the room she would be going to with real impatience. Her own place, not just one cot among many. her own place and her own